Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. And joining us now is someone who understands that one of the great engineering marvels of America is in Pennsylvania. He is the senator from Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey, and he knows that Altoona, there is a place where the Norfolk Southern Railroad, plain and simple, makes a loop, a turn. To see it, folks, is to believe it. And this is the Pennsylvania Railroad deep in the heart of his Pennsylvania. Pat Toomey, on the railroad strike, the president suggests that it is Union America. Is it Union America?
I'm not sure what exactly he means by that. But look, it's good news if we've averted a strike that could have cost the economy $2 billion a day. So I'd like to see the details. Let's see if this actually is going to hold. It was described by the White House as sort of a temporary thing. But this would be pretty devastating if this strike went forward. So let's hope we've dodged that bullet.
This is something we rarely touch, Senator, but I must touch it today. Kaylee Lyons, who does our crypto show, says you must do it now with Pat Toomey. And that is Bitcoin and crypto and the frustration over what the SEC has done, led by Gensler. You'll have hearings on this week. Kenneth Rogoff of Harvard University told me he was thunderstruck at how slow regulators have acted in the United States. He is definitive on crypto. Have they been too slow?
So I think the problem is that the SEC isn't sharing with us the framework that they're using. Gary Gensler famously argues that virtually all crypto tokens are securities. I think reasonable people can disagree with that. He would exempt Bitcoin from that classification, but pretty much everything else he says is a security. But then he doesn't go on to say how we would apply the existing frameworks that we use to regulate securities issuance and trading to a very, very new and very different technology where some of these things don't fit, right? Custody rules, clearance rules, these things don't have any application. And he hasn't provided any clarity on that. I think actually Congress should step in and provide some guidance. I think crypto is sufficiently different, even if you want to argue that these tokens are securities. You go ahead and make the argument, but you can't dispute that they're very different from a stock or a bond, and therefore Congress ought to step in and provide a framework. I'm working on that. That's going to be really hard to get done. In the meantime, Chairman Gensler owes us much more clarity on how and why he intends to apply SEC regulations.
Senator, I know that you are retiring from the Senate. Do you plan to go into the crypto industry in private sector?
I have no such plans whatsoever. I don't have anything lined up. I've got no commitments, no offers, nothing. I'm not pursuing that until I'm out of office. I've got a big job to do. I'm going to run through the tape, do this job, and then come January or February of next year, I'm sure I'll start having conversations. But I have no idea what those conversations will be about.
Senator, we got some data earlier this morning showing a lot of resilience in the economy, so much resilience that people are suggesting the Fed has to go pretty far with respect to rate hikes, including an unemployment rate that continues to remain low. Are you comfortable with an unemployment rate rising in response to tighter rates if that's what it takes to get inflation under control?
So first, let me say, I've always been a skeptic about the Phillips curve. I'm not convinced that you have to have significantly higher unemployment in order to get inflation under control. But the Fed's first job has to be a stable dollar. We don't maximize employment over the long haul unless you have a stable dollar. I also think Jim Paulson on your show earlier this morning made some very, very important points about all the ways that tightening is occurring outside of the Fed funds rate per se. That's all going to work its way into diminishing the pressure on inflation. And I'm hoping, look, the Fed's got a great luxury that you don't have in other parts of the world. And that is, they have the ability to tighten at a time when the economy is still very strong, employment is very strong. They need to get the inflation job done here.
Senator, I notice you're sterling academics, you're working foreign exchange, and then you did one of the toughest things in the world, which is run a restaurant. It is tough, tough, tough. This is a restaurant in Allentown, Pennsylvania, years ago. People running restaurants right now are getting hit over the head.
Totally.
With inflation, right. With fixed costs, with variable costs that are becoming fixed costs, and also the labor conundrum. What is the action we can see from the Washington you leave to assist Rookie's Restaurant in Allentown?
Look, the most important thing is to end this volatility, this upward trajectory, right? I mean, there's some companies are going to be able to easily pass on price increases and the inflation is not going to be that big a problem. But a lot of companies can't do that. And the small restaurants are a great example. People can choose not to eat out. People can eat at home. These small businesses, mom and pop operations, restaurants and otherwise, are the ones that are most vulnerable. That's why I think Congress should stop throwing gasoline on the fire. Our Democratic colleagues want more increases and more supplemental spending, even now, even COVID spending, for crying out loud. That we should not do. And the Fed's got to stay the course. I think that's the best outcome for our, you know, everybody working in our economy.
Senator Toomey, thank you so much for joining us. Pat Toomey is the Republican
thanks for having me.
Pennsylvania. Measured for years in the equity markets is Lizanne Saunders, Chief Investment Strategist at Charles Schwab. She has been of huge value to us. She joins us today. Lizanne, I'm going to rip up the script and go to something that Mr. Farrow said earlier, which is the linkage of the bond market to your equity space. How linked are bond dynamics right now to what we see day to day in the equity market?
Only marginally so. I think the bond market, maybe especially in this kind of environment, but I think you could say this generally, tends to have, I don't know, maybe a more rational, not irrational, message about what's going on in the economy with inflation. I think the equity market can sometimes be a bit more irrational, and the two have not been sending the same message, and I think the bond market is sending the more appropriate message. You didn't see the kind of weakness in the equity market that you would have expected when we recently saw spreads really pick back up, but I think the volatility associated with that would probably be greater with any upcoming blowout in spreads if we get that.
Watch what they do, not what they say. What is retail doing now, and for that matter, institutional doing on equity flows?
Well, in the past month or so, and this is broad flows, not just within equities, but across all asset classes. So this is not just specific to Schwab. A big renewed interest in bond funds. In fact, over the past month, you've seen close to 45% of all the inflows have been into not just broad bond funds, but government bond funds specifically. And I think that's because you've got obviously nominal yields up, but real yields as well. So I think there's a bit of that cost, but also taking advantage of the fact that there's income in fixed income now.
Lisa, that's really working out, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it is if you start now, right? But if you started 6 months ago, maybe it would have been a different story. Lizanne, we were talking earlier about the Ray Dalio call of a 20% decline in broad stock indexes. And he talked about how that's an average and you go under the hood and they're more or less with the acceptance of a 4.5% Fed funds rate. Now, that's almost what's being priced into the Fed funds rate market. Do you agree with his assessment of how much more the equity market has to fall to be in coherence with that?
So, I mean, the short and honest answer is I don't know. I don't know whether we've got another 20% downside. I'm not sure. The fact that I don't know matters all that much. Would it shock me? No. I think we have had a bit of a retreat in valuations, certainly a retreat in valuations relative to where we started 2021. But of course, that had been valuations had been artificially boosted by virtue of the pandemic related plunge in earnings. We got the recovery in earnings that brought valuations down to actually pretty reasonable levels at the lows in June, and then they pop back up again. Of course, inflation is a variable. Now we've got the rolling over in earnings estimates, which is putting upward pressure, all else equal, on valuations. You've got high inflation in a zone right now that historically has only supported, on average, a multiple in the 11 to 12 range. I'm not suggesting we have to go all the way down there because inflation is on the move and the market can discount the, to Tom's point, sort of second derivative rate of change. But the sweet spot of 0 to 2% in inflation for valuations where you've traded on average at an 18 multiple or so, to John's point about destination, there's a long way to go before even just the math allows inflation numbers to have a two handle on them. So the valuation story still suggests that there's more downside unless the retreat in inflation happens much more quickly.
More downside that could potentially be more dramatic than perhaps some people are factoring in. Lizanne, how close are you to the Oksana Aronov of JP Morgan view, where she's holding some 70% of her portfolio in ultra liquid assets preparing for a better entry point?
Well, it depends on who you are as an investor. That might be an appropriate strategy to have either if you're trading oriented or trying to catch the shorter term moves in the market. But if you are a long-term investor that has a fairly high risk tolerance, you don't need the money, you're not living on the income associated with what's generated from your portfolio, then I'd say you can take a more risk tolerant stance. If you are a retiree and you've got a nest egg and you're living on the income associated with that and you can't afford to lose any of the principal, yeah, you want to take a much more defensive stance. It really depends on who the investor is, not what mine or anybody else's opinion of what the market is going to do.
Lizanne, on dollar strength, we just hit 7.00 yuan per dollar. You go back to September of 2019, maybe a level of 7.18, something around there. That brings us to this quarter's earnings. Are we at a point where FX recalculation for American multinationals is a tangible distraction?
So the fact that the dollar has been so strong, the math suggests that we should have seen a bigger hit to earnings, but there were positive offsets. I think multiple hits are likely to come more to fruition once we get to third quarter reporting season, the dollar being one of them, the fact that we've got the demand profile that is weakened at the same time that you've got labor costs now as a share of revenues, it suggests profit margins two full percentage points lower than where they are right now. And I think just the beginning of this re-rating of earnings estimates. So we all thought we'd see it a little bit more in the second quarter, although ex-energy earnings were negative 2%. I think we're going to see it more in earnest in the third quarter.
I've aged waiting for small cap to pop. And the basic idea is small cap, mid cap is a domestic feel away from FX dynamics. Do you buy the theory?
I do, except that you've got a lot of lower quality companies in some of the bigger small cap indexes, not least being Russell 2000. And that's where some of the zombie companies have been housed and living for a while. So that's the rub. Yes, you get that more domestic bias in general to them, but you also have a bit of a lower quality profile. Valuations, because of the underperformance, have come in and the valuation spread it alone is supportive of small caps, but I think we have to weed out some of those really low quality companies before I think there can be a call that small caps are ready to have a period of sustainable outperformance.
Lizanne, before we let you get on with your morning, I have to just give you a victory lap. Your charts that you put out on Twitter are always fabulous, and you really pinpoint many of the main issues. And I wonder if there is another pivot point data entry that we could be watching for. For example, the CPI print was a pivot point for the market, and I don't mean it in the Fed's way. What's the next one? What's the next most important data point?
Well, it may not be a data point. I think it may be what Powell has to say in the press conference. You know, the big debate that erupted after the CPI report was it going to be 75? Is it going to be 100? We're still leaning towards 75 just because I'm not sure Powell wants to do shock and awe a week in advance of the meeting. I think it's more to John's point earlier about, you know, what's the destination? How long is it going to take to get there? But importantly, once we get to the destination, are we going to go in and stay for a while? I think the pivot idea, to go back to the Fed's meeting and what the market was pricing in June, was that when we got to the destination, we'd say hi and then we'd turn around and go the other way to rate cuts. I think the Fed is trying to just put that completely to bed. But anything that gives us a better sense of the level of aggressiveness that's likely to continue through at least the end of this year, and firming up this notion that once we get there, we're going to stay there for a while, I think that's the next important message coming for the market.
Lizanne, just about speaking terms with me at the moment, Lisa, because I hadn't heard of the song Wind and Rain before. Just never
mean,
heard of it.
You mean Fire and Rain?
Fire and Rain.
That's you're nailing it.
Lizanne Sonnet, a Charles Schwab.
Was that intentional?
I'll pull out Spotify later and listen to
okay,
it.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
It's painful, Lizanne. I'm sorry.
Lizanne gets to go. No, you have okay. to stay with me.
Yes.
Lizanne, thank you.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Joining us right now, a member of Stiglitz, Blanchflower and Powley, retired from the folk circuit, David Blanchflower joins us, professor of economics at Dartmouth Hello. College, and of course, formerly with the Bank of England as well. Professor Blanchflower, thank you so much for joining us. The basic idea is a public official, Jerome Powell, Joe Stiglitz, and Dean Baker write it up. They're wrong, wrong, wrong. And you're nuanced. You don't have the view of Stiglitz. Don't raise rates. There's more to it. Describe your stance here.
Well, a couple of things. I was looking at GDP growth yesterday, and since 1991, there have only been a few periods that have been negative growth. All of them, every one of them, has been as part of a thing where the NBR is called recession. 2001, 2008, 2020. This is the fourth one. The US appears to be in recession. And the NBR is likely to call recession at the start of the year. The UK is probably in recession now, too. Also, in 2008, inflation in August 2008 was 5.6%. By August 2009, it was minus 2%. We've had 2 months of zeros on the CPI. If you get that continuing forward, you'll actually get to 0.3% inflation by next June, with every expectation that the number will be lower.
Right.
So my view is that actually you're in a recession. The likelihood is that inflation is actually tumbling very fast. And in those circumstances, forget the rhetoric, you would actually be cutting rates.
Right.
And the other one, if you look at the Bank of England's forecast, the Bank of England is forecasting in the UK that in 2024, there's a 55% probability of being below one, and a 25% probability of being negative. So the reality is that what are people looking at? The expectation is that inflation's
David,
and we're in recession.
What we're looking at and we're all working off of are models from another time. And whether it's stochastic moves in inflation twice from 47 to 52, or it's Volcker's 79 to 81, whatever anyone's model is or belief, can we utilize those models given the multiple huge impulses of a pandemic?
Well, I actually, Thomas, a fantastic question. I teach a class at Dartmouth called Pandemics and Financial Crises. And I think the story you have to look at is Great War, followed by a pandemic, followed by a financial crisis, and then deflation and high unemployment. What have we seen in the last dozen years? Financial crash, pandemic, war. So that's the reality. Anything since 1945 tells you nothing about how the world is. Central banks weren't negative. They weren't doing QE. Perhaps the reality is that we have to look back at the period where there was crash pandemic. We've had crash pandemic, supply shocks, earthquakes. We have hurricanes come into Florida, which causes the shock to the housing market. So the reality is that we should look at history. And in fact, the class has been actually looking at the history of inflation. What happened after the Black Death? What happened after the eruption of volcanoes? That may be the model you need to look at.
With all due respect, a lot of people are looking at their grocery bills. A lot of people are looking at their rents. A lot of people are looking at how much it costs to go on a trip and stay in a hotel or go on a plane. And these are the things that are the anecdotal notes that are not saying that inflation is slowing down and that next year it won't either, because people are still spending on these items. So what is your concern? How high of an inflation rate would you be able to tolerate over 5 years, let's say, that would allow you to say, look, even if it only gets down to 4%, we're still winning?
Well, the reason we have inflation the last 2 months has been no inflation. So everything's been driven by base effects. And as we move forward, the large base effects drop out first. No one denies, second, that inflation hurts people. But the evidence is, I've written about it and new papers are coming out now, a 1 percentage point rise in unemployment increases pain by 10 times more than a 1 percentage point rise in inflation, partly for the reason I just told you, that inflation plummets. We're going to see it plummet to probably zero within 9 or 10 months, my guess would be, unless there's another war, unless there's another wave of the pandemic. So the reality is that inflation disappears, unemployment doesn't. So you're creating a situation which is worse. So yes, it's true that inflation hurts people. The question is the solution that you're creating worse? And the answer is undoubtedly that's true. So it takes much longer to get rid of unemployment. Unemployment hurts the unemployed and hurts everybody. Despite what the rhetoric says, all the evidence, it's completely wrong.
There are a lot of people who say that unemployment is not a goal, but it may be a necessary side effect, and just that it would rise a little bit. A little bit being the key. And those are the projections that we're seeing from the Fed, that there's slack in the market. People who have savings, who have not gone back into the labor market, gotten jobs because they don't have to. How do you push back against that and say that this labor market is not nearly as tight as people think, and that the unemployment rate could rise much more considerably than they're certainly counting on?
Well, let's go back. If you go back to September 2008, the same discussion was going on. The Fed said, all you care about is inflation. We don't think a recession's coming. Actually, the unemployment rate then, well, it went to deflation in 2009, I just told you. Unemployment went to 10% after they said that nothing was coming, there was no recession. So the reality is these people missed the Great Recession. So how can we trust them? The reality is that unemployment is going to rise. And if you look at the labor market, the employment rate is about 7 million jobs below where it was in 2000. So I take a completely contrary view to that, but you shouldn't trust what the Fed says. They missed it last time. They said it was all about inflation last time, and it wasn't. And unemployment went to 10%, which is every expectation it will do the same, caused by the Fed and the conversations you've been having with everybody.
With us, folks, David Blanchflower of Dartmouth College on Bloomberg Radio and Bloomberg Television. And David, that course you studied, I think you taught 10 years ago at Dartmouth, Blanchflower on supply side economics. I think four people signed up for the course. Tell me about Trussian supply side economics. Tell me about growth theory.
Well, my classes are waitlisted these days. I have to tell you, I've got people out in the gazoo trying to come to them. Well, I think the reality, it's pretty interesting. I've written endlessly about trust, in the sense that the things that they've written about, which is improve the supply side, go for growth, change the remit of the Bank of England, do tax cuts and corporation tax cuts.
Right.
Well, that's all very well. None of it's going to have an effect on the ordinary person who can't pay their bills. And that's how the reality is going to hit. All we've heard is an announcement in the last couple of days, fire the boss of the Treasury and raise the cap on bankers' bonuses. Well, this is going to be the only anti-populist government you've ever seen, because reality hits this week as bills come and people can't pay, and as pubs close. So the supply side is all very well, but the same people have been in power for a dozen years. So the reality is that what are you going to do by Christmas? And I've heard zero.
I've observed a Blanchflower lecture, folks, and it's quite something to see the aisles absolutely jammed at Dartmouth, and Douglas Irwin, the giant of trade, sitting in the front row, intimidating, to say the least. Danny, thank you so much. Next time, cover football. He is with Dartmouth College. Someone that knows this is Kathleen Bisjancic, Chief U.S. Economist at Outford Economics. Kathleen, I would suggest the rhetorical debate right now is the strength and the spirit of the American consumer, taken in aggregate or maybe the haves booming, maybe the bottom of the rung helping the haves get along with life, and the middle class flat on their back. Which is it into this Fed meeting? What is the state of American consumption?
Hi, Tom, and Lisa, happy to be with you. So, you know, looking through these numbers, it looks as if we lost some momentum for the consumer overall, particularly that core retail control number that Mike talked about. That's one that we look at because that feeds directly into consumer spending and GDP. And that did look a bit slower. And that's sort of in line with what we're thinking is we're going to see less ability to tap into those excess savings. Really, you talk about the different cohorts. Well, the lower and middle class have really probably extinguished all of their excess savings, where it really lies, you know, $2 trillion or so, which is sizable, is really with upper income households, which are less likely to use it to tap into that. So the key is going forward, and the mix of everything is really the labor market, because if we're correct when we're thinking the labor market's going to start to slow here, and that's what the Fed Reserve wants, that's going to hurt income and then eventually is going to slow consumer spending even more.
Lisa, how do you slow a labor market with 213,000 claims?
That's exactly where I wanted to go.
I knew that.
And Kathy, that's where I wanted to pick up, that right now we are looking at a labor market that's incredibly strong. And the latest numbers that we saw with the unemployment filings just confirms that, suggesting there really is not that much slack in this labor market. What's your sense of how that's going to change?
Yeah, and you know, you're correct, and it really does put the Federal Reserve in a tight spot. I think what it means is they tighten more ultimately, because what's going to happen if the labor market doesn't loosen and weaken as we think, and we do think that will happen, the Federal Reserve just has to do more. They need to bring wage growth down, because it's service job wage growth that's really driving core services in the CPI report, right? And ultimately, that's what the Federal Reserve has to start to bring lower.
Kathy, this is something that drives our listeners and viewers nuts. We want a institutional government policy to diminish wage growth. Is that what we really want?
It doesn't sound great, but at the end of the day, it's overheating. It's too fast for the economy's own good, right? That's the problem for the medium to long term. Pre-pandemic, wages were running 3% year over year. Now, you could argue me that was low, but now we're 5%. And we don't have the productivity gains to go along with that. So you're going to see a corporate profit margin squeeze. And that's what's going to lead to slower labor and employment growth, really.
Right. Kathy, take it over to something we haven't talked about, and it's odd that we haven't done that from across the Atlantic, and that is X minus M trade. Does trade in any way, exports and imports, does it devolve into the Fed discussion announced Wednesday?
Plays a minor role. We're still largely a closed economy compared to other countries. Now, we will see some knock-on effects from the recession we believe is going to unfold in Europe, right? That looks more than likely at this point. But it's really the confidence. That's going to have a confidence effect on CEOs, not so much a direct impact, right? If you look at European exports, for the U.S., it counts for 2% of our GDP, so it's pretty small. I think the bigger issue maybe for the Fed, and they won't talk publicly about it, but it's the strength of the dollar, right? And that's and there's good news and bad news. The good news is it helps bring inflation down. Bad news, it hurts multinational companies when they repatriate their earnings back to the U.S., right? So it just adds to the idea that we think eventually companies would have to pull back on the hiring reins.
So I want to go back, Kathy, before we let you go, to the philosophical point that Danny Blanchflower of Dartmouth raised, where he said that there is an asymmetry of risk and that Fed Chair Jay Powell is looking at it wrong. And that if we get unemployment higher, which is essentially by design with some of these rate policies, that it will become entrenched and it will be a bigger loss for the economy than just leaving rates low for longer. What's your view?
Well, no one wants people to lose their job, right, and to see the unemployment rate go up. But the worst outcome, I believe, it would be if we see inflation remain elevated to the medium to long term. It just obscures, right, it gets in the way of business decisions. And it really does put pain disproportionately on the lower income households. They're facing much higher inflation rates than the rest. So it's a little bit of pain in the near term. Hopefully it's a mild recession, but it does look like we're headed towards recession. And the Fed's going to is going to take that bet, right? They're going to say mild recession or recession is better than having inflation linger on.
Kathleen, thank you so much. Kathy Bosjansk with us with Oxford Economics. Nuance there and some of the dynamics that we are seeing.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.